interrupting the current neo-uranial climate-changed, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM 491. This is the most jam-packed minute radio for 2 continuous hours break-free, folks. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport. So get you behind the woodshed. It's up to you to do your part to protect yourself. And I don't know what more to say about that. If we haven't figured that out since when? Since they put the E-types to us relative to this public health nuisance. And no one responded. It really got me kind of interested that we didn't do it as a society. We don't even know about our rights. And last week I did the part one, it turns out. Hopefully I'll be able to do part two and finish up everything I wanted to say in part one. Last week we were doing and discussing the police power, and by definition, and due process, which it is hinged on, which is I'm telling you the important part about all this. Any police power has to require that. And then the concepting relative to false imprisonment. And that's where I then brought up the idea of how we looked at, for instance, this is just one of the instances of a police power that was beat up on us relative to the health thing, because that was obvious to see. Anything that an officer does or some public official does is can be subject to that. And also third parties, as we heard last week as I was reading through. So today we're going to pick up from there. We heard last week, essentially, in a nutshell, how simple the action is, how simple the elements are. Reading, I think, from page 2 of the last week's article, we said for false imprisonment is a great offense due to the high regard of the law has for liberty. In Chitty's practice of law, it states, the infraction of personal liberty has ever been regarded as one of the greatest injuries. The injuries to liberty are principally termed, quote, false imprisonments or malicious prosecutions, close quote. Unlawful detention or deprivation of liberty is the basis for an action for the tort of false imprisonment. Actual seizure or the lay on of hands is not necessary to constitute an unlawful detention. Thus, the only essential elements of the action are 1, detention, a restraint against one's will, and 2, the unlawfulness of such detention or restraint. So they don't have to lay on of hands of you. The fact of the detention of what you intended to do is sufficient to bring this action on. And when I looked at that, I said, this is really cool because what this tends to do, it puts the burden on the other side really, really, really fast, like a habeas does. So we go back to what the example I'm trying to use that was clearly in the law, clearly to see. The unfulfilled duty of a health officer regarding any communicable disease, which imposes a restriction liberty, is really a false imprisonment. So put that in context with what we've been talking. Last week I talked about John Jay and what he was talking about, the incident report. As I was mentioning, you had to do a report of some kind to call out the problem, to document it for yourself. Don't just whine about it. You have to go ahead and make the facts, develop the facts at the moment that it's happening to you. So this is something you have to do. This is not something that someone else does. This is not something that you say. This is not something that you claim. These are essential elements to build up when the incident happens against you. And in this case, they said there's no laying on of hands. There's also no need to go to jail. The very fact and moment that you're stopped to do what you have right to do by someone is enough to consider it a false imprisonment. And whether or not ultimately it's found to be one, that's whether or not you've made your record. Picking up from last week relative to the false imprisonment discussion, and how there's an example in Charles Weissman's article. It's a document I have. I think you can find it on the internet. I think Sound Lines did find it for himself to be able to show you some of it. is that we'll pick up where we left off of bringing, and now this becomes official, not just third party here, like businesses and things like that, or people getting in the face. And this can get, the more I thought about it, this can get kind of wild, but you don't want to get frivolous about how you pull this together. Not every interaction that stops you in a moment is going to be something like a false imprisonment. We're typically dealing with officials here and how you need, or somebody relying on an official that does nice to you what everyone else otherwise has the right to do. And so we'll pick up here from the document again, around page 63, and bringing an arrested person before a magistrate. And again, don't argue with these terms, just read for the information. I see lots of people arguing with what I'm saying. Don't argue with what I'm saying. Understand this is what is going on. You have to deal with it on those terms. Your opinion of it will not really have any force and effect. Your opinion might give you a grounds to believe different, and then it gives you the power to frame differently what's going on, but which is what you need to do, not let them define who you are, what you are, status, and such. But if you argue with the way this is written out, and then secondarily you have to bring this up to date since this article was since written in 93 to make sure what the how the courts have treated these since then, and confirm in your state where they are. If you argue with me, you're arguing with the wrong guy. If you argue with the definitions, you're arguing with the wrong definitions relative to what you think they are or aren't, and because this is how they're being dealt with. So we got to come to terms with that, and I've found that when I deal with them on these terms, I am able to deal with them much more effectively. And so, I'm going to go on. If you're talking to yourself and trying to argue with me over the existence or non-existence of the things, or the rightness or wrongness, you're missing what I'm trying to explain to people here. You're set for yourself, and you're getting in the way of understanding a thing you need to understand, whether or not it ends up being completely applicable for you, and then the condition. But moving on to the article now and reading page 63 as I have it, I don't know which page this is, if on a document or PDF, but bringing an arrested person before a magistrate is a very interesting thing. If you didn't know, go look in most states, I think all states, required an arrested person to be brought before a magistrate. So when a cop arrests you, in this case, duty of an officer, we assume it's a public law officer, when they arrest you for some whatever reason, they're to bring you, due process, the legislature requires the executive bring you before a magistrate, and that typically is your preliminary hearing, so you got to know your stuff there about how to avoid if you can. But that's not supposed to be, as you heard last week, it was found that an officer who dropped an arrested person, let's use that word generic term, don't get triggered, to a jail and hand them into custody of someone else and walked away and didn't bring them, was found to be liable to a cause of false imprisonment, because the law, due process required, the proper handling of that party was to bring them before a magistrate. And that's what this section now talks about. So there's I've heard a lot of things that's happened to me. I've never seen it happen, like I said last week, that anyone's been brought before a magistrate. In fact, inquiring on who the magistrate is that's on duty to do this, I've never been able to get an answer from. So it seems to me the system doesn't even have one and hasn't expected to for a long time. And yet, it constitutes an ancient trespass upon me, an abuse as assault. And how many people are you seeing clamoring, if nothing more, clamoring for to stop this abuse? Is showing us the crickets that we've become as a society. Moving into Charles Weissman's 1993 to 96 document here, duty of officer. It's a fundamental rule of procedure, well grounded in the common law, that where an arrest is made, the alleged offender is to be taken, quote, before a magistrate to be dealt with according to the law, close quote. This is not only to be done, but done without delay, or without a necessary delay. Otherwise, the arresting party is liable for a false imprisonment. The Blackstone's Commentaries, Volume 4, Chapter 21, page 292, it was stated that a constable may, without warrant, arrest anyone for a breach of the peace committed in his view and carry him before a justice of the peace, close quote. The officer must bring a person he has arrested directly to a magistrate, otherwise it is a breach of duty. Otherwise, it is a breach of duty. Now, I have to interject that, because I've told you early on with the Kobe fraud, we jump in and find the duty of an official. Otherwise, the failure to comport to that legislative mandate would be a breach of that duty. Moving back to the article to read, it is the duty of an officer or other person making an arrest to take the prisoner before a magistrate with reasonable diligence and without unnecessary delay. And the rule is well settled that whether the arrest is made with or without a warrant, an action for false imprisonment may be predicated upon an unreasonable delay in taking the person arrested before a magistrate, regardless of the lawfulness of the arrest, in the first instance. And again, I'm not reading the footnotes. If you see them, whoever's doing a video on this, and they show these documents, I'm not going to read the citations. You can get the document and read them yourself and research them, and I encourage you to do so. It will be too cumbersome for me to do that here. Just continue on the text. And as I said, you still have to confirm for your state, wherever state you are, that what the due process in common law is still been accepted by the legislature and in the statutes reproduced. And we're then analyze whether that has been done, and if it has, whether or not that is still, is it making sure it's consistent with the prior common law and not inconsistent to the point that it causes a material breach to the right. So there's a little bit of an analysis here. We all have to do it. It's not just me saying this. This is what we're supposed to do to be people who understand their system and know what the due process is to be expected from both sides. So moving back into the discussion. Thus, even if the arrest was lawful, a failure to take the person arrested to a magistrate will be regarded as unlawful imprisonment. As the Supreme Court of Minnesota held, even though an arrest be lawful, a detention of the prisoner for an unreasonable time without taking him before a committing magistrate will constitute false imprisonment. In an exhaustive decision on the common law rule of the process and procedure for arrest, the Supreme Court in Mississippi, in the case of Orrick v. State, said, quote, by the common law of England, close quote, with arrest without warrant for a felony, close quote, can be made, quote, only for the purpose of bringing the offender before a civil magistrate, close quote. And these quotes are kind of cumbersome, and I'm thinking about maybe I might relieve myself from them, and you too, to have to be so precise. You can read maybe the document. I'll drop those from now on also. I'll try to put a little different inflection on the reading when it's in a quote relative to the statement here. But again, you need to see this. I say you got to read this stuff for yourself. You need to get that case, read it, see if it's still standing precedent, and then understand what it was about, and then see if it applies to you. And if it does, then you can apply its principle. I wouldn't apply the case, apply the principle. Also remember, this is about without a warrant. That's different than trying to say the Fourth Amendment applies. So be careful on getting too encumbering your mind with too much to think about relative to what we're speaking of in this regard. Now, this procedure, it goes on to write here, Charles Reisman writes, this procedure is the due process of law, not to be followed in depth, depriving one of his liberties. Thus, a failure or even a delay in following this process is an unlawful restraint or deprivation of liberty, and thus a type of false imprisonment. The arresting officer has no authority to take a person to a jail and detain him there. His duty is to take the one arrested without delay to a court or magistrate, as said the Supreme Court of Kansas. Toto spoke and said, the law contemplates that an arrest, either by an officer or a private person, with or without a warrant, is a step in a public prosecution and must be made with a view of taking the person before a magistrate or judicial tribunal for examination or trial, and an officer even subjects himself to liability if there is an unreasonable delay after an arrest in presenting the person for examination or trial. The only reason that can justify having an arrested person in jail or detained by the arresting officer is as a necessary step in bringing him before a magistrate, as so stated by the Supreme Court of Rhode Island. When an officer makes an arrest without a warrant, it is his duty to take the person arrested without unnecessary delay before a magistrate or other proper judicial official having jurisdiction in order that he may be examined and held or dealt with as the case requires. But to detain the person arrested in custody for any purpose other than that of taking him before a magistrate is illegal. Thus, detainment in a jail for purposes of booking or fingerprinting or investigating the alleged crime or interrogation of the person is illegal. In cases involving the commission of most severe crimes, as in felonies, one arresting is still required without unnecessary delay to bring the prisoner to the nearest red magistrate or court as a matter of a fundamental law. Now remember, that court has to have jurisdiction, lawful jurisdiction. And for those of you that understand what I've been talking about, granted rights and things, and the status of a trustee to those granted to the grantee, you're going to find out here that there is no court that has jurisdiction. There's no place they can actually take you. It's a fundamental breach right on its face. Interjection. Now, we'll get back to the writing here. From the earliest dawn of the common law, the constable could arrest without warrant when he had reasonable grounds to suspect that a felony had been committed and he was authorized to detain the suspect party such as a reasonable length of time as would enable him to carry the accused before a magistrate. And this is still the law of the land. The court went on to state that the officer making the arrest is liable for false imprisonment if he arrests with the intent of only detaining or if his unreasonable delay causes a detainment. And on page 1092, it stated, it cannot be questioned that when a person is arrested, either with or without a warrant, it becomes the duty of the officer or the individual making the arrest to convey the prisoner in reasonable time and without unnecessary delay before a magistrate to be dealt with as the exigency of the case may require. The power to make the arrest does not include the power to unduly detain in custody, but on the contrary, is coupled with a correlative duty incumbent on the officer to take the accused before a magistrate as soon as he reasonably can, authority cited. If the officer fails to do this and unreasonably detains the accused in custody, he will be guilty of false imprisonment, no matter how lawful the original arrest may have been. Thus, where a person arrested is taken to jail or a sheriff's office and detained there with no warrant issued before or after the arrest, it is a false imprisonment. The one arresting has, quote, a duty to immediately seek a magistrate, and that the failure to do so makes a case of false imprisonment as a matter of law is held by all authorities. There's a citation for that. As a matter of law, folks, you're looking at very direct things. As I said, it's an ancient right, an inviolable right that not even the party can get rid of, not even you, the unalienable, not inalienable, that's a political right. Inalienable rights are political rights. Unalienable is a inherent right. You can't even give that up. It's inherent in you. You can't be separated. Remember that from last week. This is a matter of law condition. This is outside of judges' opinion now. So when you read some of these discussions, I get kind of excited in a way. I say, well, here's how clear it is. How we got so far messed up and why we're still crickets is really an astonishing thing to me when I see it so clear here. If you ever, anybody worked with me and I start bringing out these terms, you'll have seen me put matter of law where it's a law. It's a matter of a principle of law that's unsettled and it's undeniable and it can't be challenged. It happens as a matter of course. In other words, I talked to you about the equity condition that we sued in 2013. It was a matter of law. When they failed to respond, it went to default. That's what a default is. This is not supposed to wait around on people. Equity happens now because there's immediately irreparable harm. It needs to be stopped immediately, and not, if not sooner, as we see also is in the law. That's not just a joke to happen if not sooner. The court can move before anybody else gets the paperwork if the irreparable harm is that egregious. And so learning these basics, not arguing with them, but learning these basics may empower you to do these things. We're not talking about equity here. We're actually talking the tort at law of the false imprisonment. What I'm telling you is that there's support for all this. And the habeas corpus is a hybrid remedy between equity and the at law. And so it's an interesting one. But it reads the same if you look at this. It's unrestrained. It's an unwarranted restraint of liberty, isn't it? That's what the habeas corpus is supposed to relieve the party restrained of, right? The burden's on the other officer. It's just a different action. It has a similar effect in that you get released. What's interesting, it's not an action in tort for a false imprisonment, even though it's the same thing, essentially. And so you start looking at that instead of arguing with that. You just look at, oh, these are different types of jurisdictions they're talking. then you start to be able to field what's going on and understand more clearly how the courts parse things out, and it's not so nebulous sometimes. In other words, if I say a matter of law, I know there's a real substantial thing behind this. There's a rule, there's a principle, there's something that's acting by the condition. The condition demands by the principle that it be done as a matter of law. The law then rules, not an opinion of a judge or an agency or whatever else goes on. Getting back to the article now. See, it's easy to get off. I can talk about lots of things. Maybe that's good, maybe that's bad for context, but there's so much that could be learned. But this case, these false imprisonments are really fascinating to me in that they're really that simple. Not all of you being stopped in the street will have a false imprisonment necessarily, but it's all how you understand and frame the condition and the element and the looking at the defenses we talked about, I think, last week. But here we have an officer who simply does not bring you before a magistrate when he has arrested you. That is a false imprisonment. Now, the delay, there's a caveat, and the courts have adjusted those. That's why I say go confirm, but that time there is a necessary delay provision. You got to find out what that is. So you understand what that is. The battlefield would say he can assert, or she can assert that, the officer can assert that you're going to have to be able to answer to that and take it away. So back to the writing here. In a case involving an indictment for assault and false imprisonment, the Supreme Court of North Carolina held that in the process of lawful arrest, one arrested is to be taken immediately to a judge. The question occurs, what is the officer to do with the offender when he shall have been arrested without a warrant? All the authorities agree that he should be carried as soon as conveniently, maybe before some justice of the peace. Though this case involved an arrest without a warrant, the court says it is the duty of an arresting officer upon making an arrest, whether with a warrant or without one, to carry the offender at once before a justice. Let me interject again. You know, this is very, very consistent across the board as well. And there is no hesitation about the consistency across the board. And all you're doing is making sure that this consistency still holds up within the state that you're in. Because it sounds like this document was kind of interesting going around to different state Supreme Courts to show it's all similarly situated. And the due process is a requirement of law, as I was pointing out in police power. It's due process. This is not just a tyrant doing things. Everything has to go by reason and procedure, as you heard in the last few sentences specifically being talked about. Moving to the back to the article, to take an arrested person to jail to be detained and fingerprinted in violation of his rights, it is proof the officer had no intent to bring the accused directly to a judge. In Anderson's treatise on law and sheriffs, the subject of the officer's duty after arrest was examined with this conclusion. It is the undoubted right of the part of a prisoner on being arrested by the public officer or private citizen, and unquestionably a corresponding duty on the part of the one making the arrest, to take the prisoner before a court or magistrate for a hearing or examination, and this must be done without unnecessary delay. The object of this right and corresponding duty is that the prisoner may be examined, held, or dealt with as the law directs, I repeat that, as the law directs and the facts of the case require. It is highly improper and an invasion of the lawful rights of the prisoner to take him to any other place than to a proper court or magistrate. In deciding the proper duty and action of the arresting officer after making an arrest, the Supreme Court of Appeals of Virginia stated that the right of the accused to a prompt judicial examination does not depend upon their statute law. But even if the circumstances of the arrest were not within the purview of this particular statute, it was the duty of the arresting officer taking the defendant within a reasonable time or without unnecessary delay before a judicial officer in order that the latter might inquire into the matter and determine whether a warrant should be issued for the detention of the defendant and whether he should be released. And in speaking of what the manner of arrest were lawful at common law and what are the procedures under common law when an arrest is made, the Supreme Court of Rhode Island held that coupled with the authority to arrest went an imperative obligation on the officer to bring the arrested person before a magistrate without an unreasonable delay. Especially was this true where the arrest had been made without a warrant. When an officer makes an arrest without a warrant, it is his duty to take the person arrested without unnecessary delay before a magistrate or other proper judicial officer having jurisdiction, in order that he may be examined and held or dealt with as the case requires, but to detain the person arrested in custody for any purpose other than that of taking him before a magistrate is illegal. This rule of law, requiring an officer or person arresting to bring the party arrested before a magistrate, is the same in all states and cannot be abrogated by statute. The same rule has been upheld in the federal courts, as it is prescribed under Title 18 in the Rules of Criminal Procedure. An officer making an arrest under a warrant issued upon a complaint, or any person making an arrest without a warrant, shall take the arrested person without an unnecessary delay before the nearest available federal magistrate, or in the event that the federal magistrate is not reasonably available, before a state or local judicial officer authorized by 18 U.S.C. 3041, Section 3041. In a federal case, if you can't hear all this due process that's being violated in everybody all the time, I don't know what more to say. All this stuff is there if you read enough. You start seeing it. And interjection all here, but you see the federal then hands it over to the state. There's to be an officer somewhere, a magistrate, a judge, with competency, with jurisdiction to handle this situation. How many times have you ever seen this happen? This is why we're crickets, I think, and how far we are from undoing this condition in ourselves. We're prisoners in our own mind already. We talk about rights. We don't know the first thing about when they begin or when they end. And it's all about, if you've listened very carefully, that the duty of the officials. And it's up to us to find where those duties are. Why I went to the communicable disease law to find out what the duties are. Where's the breach? Has there been a breach? How would I know unless I go find the objective legislative mandated procedures? So getting to the article again, in a federal case where a man was arrested by two FBI agents assisted by two local policemen on an outstanding warrant for bank robbery, the agents placed the man in a police vehicle, drove a few blocks, and then parked on the street under a street lamp. The officers interviewed the man concerning the crime, and within a few minutes he confessed to the crime. The Federal Court of Appeals said the confession was inadmissible and reversed his conviction, as the momentary parking of the police vehicle en route from the place of arrest was a detour from the path toward a prompt presentment before a magistrate. The court stated, the law requires an arresting officer to bring an accused before a magistrate as quickly as possible. The rights of the accused were violated, and he was not, quote, promptly taken before a judicial officer as the law required, close quote. But instead was questioned while held in custody. It is said that the police are guilty of oppression and negligent of duty when they willfully detain a prisoner without arraigning him before a magistrate within a reasonable time. As they say that, as I read that last sentence and then another again, an interjection here, the reasonable time has been extended by days. But if you noticed before, this is an inherent power within you that can't be divested in you. And that reasonable time that the legislature may give, you also heard, is not subject to the legislature. In fact, if you know what you're looking at, you can declare that statute's not good relative to you. And so understand that here what's built inside what he's saying, what he's been writing, what he's developing, that we don't even understand that we can challenge this. As I said before, the rules of civil procedure are there to keep order in the courts and keep the court functioning and moving the case along and all this kind of stuff. Anything that becomes prejudicial as a rule can be waived. And I told you I've done it, and it was granted a complete waiver of all the rules not prejudicial to the court or the other party or myself. And they granted that. I stated that it was now an obstruction. Those rules become an obstruction. All the formalities and all this thing you're supposed to do and the paper and the cowbees and all this other stuff. I just needed a simple answer. So I moved to waive those rules, the civil rules of the Supreme Court. They granted that. They still deny me access to the judicial courts of the state, but that's another problem, different problem. They waive those rules. These rules all work until they're unlawful or inapplicable or they don't work. And so this is another, you just can't waive anything. They have to go specifically into what the purpose is and how they're interfering with something else that's at least of a material right in yours. You heard the statutes do not control this. This is a long time before, and I told you before, the common law must be met by the statute. And where it's not, you can challenge it. The courts themselves have said no statute can stop this condition. It's inviolable. It's an unalienable right. And we are just in a discussion. It's not unalienable, okay? We just get off of that. I told you this about before. Let's stop that right there. It's not about liens. It's not about commerce. You bring it right into commerce. That's redemption stuff. Actually, nonsense, ultimately. Unalienable. It cannot be alienated. Made alien. You cannot be made foreign to your own inherent right. It's unalienable. So getting back to the discussion here. The reasonable time that's in statute may not be reasonable in right. And so you have to understand this stuff, but that's my interjecting to this document. Whether you get it or not, it's a total different thing, but there it's there to understand. If you hadn't heard that before, go look for it and then and make sure that it's that I'm telling you the truth, because that's important that you know, not because of what I say, but because of what you've discerned through your hopefully extensive research and trying to figure out what happened to this place, why are we in such a bad state, and what is my part in it, and how am I going to extract myself, or at least, as I told you last week, neutralize the offender, official offender. Because I'm not sure if we're getting justice at all, if we can get it, notwithstanding that the term is pretty undefined anyway. What is real justice is kind of an interesting and subjective determination. Getting back to the article here now. In a case where a person sued for being arrested without warrant and confined in a jail without examination before a court or magistrate, it was found on appeal that such action was unlawful, and the Supreme Court of Illinois held, we are of the opinion the arrest of the plaintiff was illegal, and the verdict contrary to the law and the evidence. And if the arrest was legal, they did not proceed according to law and take him before a magistrate for examination, but conveyed him to another county, and they there imprisoned him in the county jail in a filthy cell, thus invading one of the dearest and most sacred rights of the citizen, secured to him by the Great Charter of our land. The requirement of bringing an arrested person directly to a court or judge is due process of law, and as such, this procedure cannot be abrogated by statute. As a trespasser ab initio, under the heading as a trespasser ab initio, from the beginning. It is a familiar rule of law that one who abuses an authority given to him by law becomes a trespasser ab initio. That is, he becomes a wrongdoer from the beginning of his actions. Where one fails to take a prisoner he was arrested to a proper judge, or where he causes an unreasonable delay in doing so, the officer becomes a trespasser ab initio. The unlawful confinement by an officer makes this entire transaction, including the arrest, unlawful and a trespass. Thus, even in the case where an executive officer has made an unlawful arrest, if he fails to bring the arrested person to a magistrate, he becomes a trespasser ab initio and is liable. An officer who has lawfully arrested a prisoner may be guilty of false imprisonment if he holds him for an unreasonable length of time without presenting him to a hearing or procuring a proper warrant for his detention. The New York Supreme Court of Appeals stated that the New York exposition of the law in a case where it had said that even though the arrest was made, was legal and justified, the officers became trespassers ab initio, and so continued to the time of the plaintiff's release because of their failure to take him before a magistrate as required. The Court of Claims of New York, in a case where the officers delayed in the claimant's arraignment, held that if there was an unnecessary delay in arraignment to the claimant before a justice of the peace, then the arrest itself became unlawful on the theory that the defendants were a trespasser ab initio, and so continued down to the time when the plaintiff was lawfully held under a warrant of commitment, regardless of whether or not the plaintiff was guilty of any crime. The numerous cases are cited there. In this case of Pastor versus Regan, it is said that the rule laid down in the sixth carpenter's case at 8 Cook 146 that if a man abuses an authority given him by a law, he becomes a trespasser ab initio, has never been questioned. Has never been questioned. So you have a fraud from the beginning. It vitiates everything after. It just sounds just like trespass, ab initio. It sounds just like fraud. And it vitiates everything after it. So you can figure here to equate fraud as part of this equation. And what did I say was going on with the health officers based in the communicable disease fiasco? Another fraud. And it negates, vitiates everything after everything. Nothing survives. So there's those of you that do study, that's a couple of your maxims about fraud. Equity is to eschew that, just immediately look to destroy it and root it out. But you're looking at courts in the country that have forgotten that. They've become trespassers ab initio. And they have a lot of ways to say that, make excuses that they don't have to put that in or apply that. It's really fascinating. And then the populace believes it's okay and keeps moving on, thinking that the next best politician's going to fix it for them. Again, I said the system. It's a systemic condition. It's an occupation that you're living. You're living in an occupied country. It's occupied by people that are in the camouflage of in the color of authority, not having any, and not doing any law, and not doing any things as a matter of law. They do what they can get away with. And they do that because none of us step up and do a simple little, even just simple, oh, I'm tired of having you stop me and do this stuff. You stopping me and stopping my intention and what I want to have lawful to do, that's going to bring you into liability, at least to an action of false imprisonment. And we'll see what happens from here. And my thought is, if we again use a simple little case like this where you legitimately have these false imprisonments, these very minor, what appear to be minor obstructions to your locomotion, your restraint of your liberty, I think some of this stuff starts to, all these minor things the cops are doing and officials will just have to stop. I just think they stop them. They realize that there is no defense against it. And my object has been always to look for the most simple measures to and remedies to make it simple for people to understand and or accomplish so that it's not complicated. You don't complicate it. You don't. I'm just talking to a friend of mine. He's over asking for some information. He goes, yeah, you're right. You don't want to make new, try to allow another argument. Otherwise, it just got more to talk about. You go, yeah, when you're talking, in this case, you're talking about a right of ingress and egress. Why talk about anything else? You don't have to get involved in anything else. So you have to learn not to engage someone who just brings up the things that make it look like it's important. But actually, for your cause and to your point, it's absolutely irrelevant. Where one was arrested for being intoxicated and confined to prison without judicial inquiry, it was held to be a wrongful imprisonment. On this matter, the Supreme Court of Washington stated, nor is a police officer authorized to confine a person indefinitely whom he lawfully arrested. It is his duty to take him before some court having jurisdiction of the offense and make a complaint against him. Any undue delay is unlawful and wrongful and renders the officer himself and all persons aiding and abetting therein wrongdoers from the beginning. Thus, when one fails to perform part of his duty and impinges upon the rights of a citizen, he is said to be a trespasser from the beginning because his whole justification fails and it stands as if he never had any authority to act at all. Detainment is not a decision of an arresting officer. And this is where we start getting into the back into the ministerial discretionary kind of thing and how to identify what's going on. And if you listen very carefully, I'm interjecting here, not written, but if you listen very carefully, the officers are trained on how to move this from the ministerial part to the discretionary part. Like there's an investigation, but you heard if there's an investigation with attainment without a charge or not brought you, bringing you right immediately before a magistrate, that's a false imprisonment, notwithstanding the investigation. So moving into the article again, detainment is not a decision of the arresting officer. The basis of the well-established procedure in law of taking a person arrested directly to a judge or court is to avoid having the liberty of the citizen unjustly dealt with by extrajudicial acts of the executive officer. We believe that fundamental fairness to the accused requires that he should, with reasonable promptness, be taken before a magistrate in order to prevent the application of the methods of approaching what is commonly called the third degree. Fundamental fairness prohibits the secret inquisition in order to obtain evidence. Other reasons for the purpose of this rule requiring that the arrested accused be taken before a magistrate is as quickly as possible is to make certain that the person arrested is advised by a judicial officer of his constitutional rights. This is not a duty of the officer through an erroneous Miranda warning. The only reason such warnings are being used is because the police are not doing their duty in bringing the person arrested to a judicial officer, but instead are unlawfully taking them to a jail to have them booked. The detainment of a person after he is arrested is a judicial question. A judicial officer must decide if there are grounds for holding the person arrested, or whether he must be further examined by trial, or if he is to be bailed and released. To allow the executive department such powers of decision-making is the epitome of despotism. In a suit for a false imprisonment where several officers arrested the plaintiff on the grounds he committed a felony, the Supreme Court of Massachusetts held that the officers had no right to decide to detain the plaintiff to enable them to make a further investigation of the charge against him. The court declared, but having so arrested him, it was the officer's duty, to take him before a magistrate who could determine whether or not there was a ground to hold him. It was not for the arresting officers to settle that question. The arresting officer is in no sense his guardian and can justify the arrest only by bringing the prisoners before the proper court, that either the prisoner may be liberated or that further proceedings may be instituted against him. Now, understand the importance when they said this has to be done by the judicial officer. Understand your government, how it was established. You have the three tripartite system condition, and each has their part. And this is what this is explaining to you. You don't understand that, you're not going to understand why this is the way this is supposed to be. And understand they said that the judge is to actually look to protect your constitutional rights. I'm reading this to you, and I'm thinking as I'm reading a foreign document to whatever I've ever experienced. We live in a foreign land, but that's what the occupier did. Going back to the article, as I start to get lost in my thoughts. A lot of life spent trying to figure this out, to find out we lived in a place that was set up for the takedown, and we didn't realize that. We were too ignorant to see that. And it takes decades of reading. Hopefully I've accelerated some of you toward the better understanding, hopefully beyond what I know eventually, to see the Matrix is not a movie. We've been brought into a system that was made to contain us, the prison, and we don't even recognize it. Moving into the discussion here on the article, Charles Weissman, 1993, originating time to 1996, I think this is copyrighted at. In a case where one was accused by another of stealing a watch, and subsequently arrested and put into jail for 1 hour and then released, the sheriff was found guilty of false imprisonment as he failed to take the person arrested before a magistrate. The Supreme Court of Indiana upheld the conviction, stating that the power of detaining a person arrested or restraining him of this liberty is not a matter within the discretion of the officer making the arrest. The court further stated that the sheriff cannot legally hold the person arrested in custody for a longer period of time than is reasonably necessary under all the circumstances of the case without possessing a proper warrant or taking him before a magistrate. If he does, it is false imprisonment. Thus, where a sheriff who has arrested two prisoners and detained them for 5 hours without making any effort to take them before a magistrate, he was guilty of false imprisonment. In this case, the Supreme Court of Idaho said the rules seems to be that an officer arresting a person on criminal process who omits to perform a duty required by law, such as taking the prisoner before the court, becomes liable for false imprisonment. The law never allows an officer at his discretion to imprison the person arrested or detain him in a jail for arrest. We have no doubt that the exercise of the power of detention does not rest wholly with the officer making the arrest, and that he should, within a reasonable time, take the prisoner before a circuit, criminal, or other judicial court. In a case where the arrest is made under a warrant, the officer must take the prisoner without any unnecessary delay before the magistrate issuing it, in order that the party may have a speedy examination if he desires it. And in the case of an arrest without a warrant, the duty is equally plain for the same reason, to take the arrested person before some officer who can take such proof as many may be afforded. Executive officers or clerks are not to determine if a person arrested is to be held or released upon bail or fix the amount of bail, since the power to do so is judicial. Let me interject a little bit here. What they do, though, is they delay you for 5 days. Statutorily, they don't look at this part, and then the judge does have a bail hearing. So they've kind of covered this little part up. I've not found, at the point of the bail hearing, it's always been given by a judge, but what they do is that they'll delay you up to 5 days before they give it to you. And then they started eliminating the own recognizance portion, which is your word, which they should issue without any hesitation. But see, this becomes also a bank, and so they're asking for as much bonding and stuff in their system of bonds in order to make that work. But back to some of this, I've never really seen that they don't offer the bail. The judge does that. The delay comes in the statutory time that they delay you getting there to hear the judge, and then none of us know the rights and how we might avoid it. But more importantly, if they had no right to arrest you sitting there for 5 days or whatever, 4 days, 3 days, whatever they want to do before you get to see the judge, when they had no right to begin with. And so that's why it becomes constitutionally improper, and the statutes can't hold up to these times and delays they call reasonable or necessary because of the business of the court. No, your liberty is supposed to transcend even all that, if you understand what they were saying earlier about the inviolability of this unalienable condition and right inherent in you. Moving back to the article. Executive officers or clerks are not to determine the person arrested. Understand, the executive branch here is what they're talking about. The judiciary has its function, the executive has their function, and they are to follow what the legislature has determined is to be the law that we all follow. In a case where a person was lawfully arrested for driving on an automobile while intoxicated, the arresting officer delivered him to the jailer at 4:30 p.m. with the instruction that he be held there until 9 o'clock p.m., at which time he was to be brought before the judicial officer. The Supreme Court of Appeals of Virginia condemned this act, asserting that the officer usurped the function of a judicial officer. But the actions of the arresting officer and the jailer in denying the defendant this opportunity, the judicial review, by confirming him in the jail, because they concluded that he was not in such a condition to be admitted to bail, had the effect of substituting their discretion in the matter for that of the judicial officer. Under the circumstances here, the defendant was clearly entitled to the benefit of a judicial opinion and judgment upon the question of his eligibility for bail. This right was arbitrarily denied to him. And understand the importance of what I've been telling you about framing your case under the circumstances here. For this case, this party, this thing went on, their fact is different than yours. So you got to make sure that you're correct in what you're doing. Executive officers cannot hold a person in order to keep complete paperwork or make out reports. Thus, where a man was arrested without warrant and confined in the county jail without a commitment, the sheriff could not justify the confinement of a man by awaiting for the pleasure of a deputy or on anyone else to file a complaint. The power of the executive officer over a person's liberty ends with the lawful arrest, and he never has discretionary power to detain the person without judicial authority. If the plaintiff was being detained for a purpose of arrest, it was the duty of the arresting officer to take him before the examining magistrate as soon as the nature of the circumstances would reasonably permit. The power to arrest does not confer upon the arresting officer the power to detain a prisoner for other purposes. Under the heading arresting and releasing without bringing before a judge, while most of the emphasis on this type of false imprisonment deals with the delay, in presenting a prisoner to a judge, the real duty and requirement is the actual bringing, carrying, or presenting the prisoner before a judge. Thus, a complete failure to do this is obviously unlawful, and this most often occurs when the officer releases the person he arrested without judicial presentment. An officer who arrests an individual does not have the authority to place such a person in jail or other holding place and then later release him, as was revealed in the case of Harness versus Steele, where the sheriff placed the person arrested in jail for an hour and then released him without bringing him before a justice of the peace. He was thus guilty of false imprisonment. It has been a common practice for an arrested person to be taken to a jail or police station to be booked, fingerprinted, photographed, measured, questioned, imprisoned, and then released after paperwork is completed. This wicked and oppressive procedure is so far removed from what due process of law requires, it is shocking that such measures could be widely accepted as legal. The process of imprisonment and release at the discretion of the executive officer was condemned by the Supreme Court of Illinois in stating, when officers assume the power to imprison without authority of law or without any forms of or processes usual and necessary to be employed, they become liable for false imprisonment. Now, maybe let me state this is not false arrest or malicious prosecution. This is a different thing. This is false imprisonment. Don't get them confused. I just remembered I better assert that because this document continually makes that distinction. It's easy to confuse and get wrong. The liberty of the citizen cannot be so far trifled with that any constable in the land may, at his own volition, commit and hold him in custody until it suits his convenience and pleasure to release him. When a constable or sheriff decides to release that person arrested without taking him before a magistrate, he assumes judicial powers upon himself and is liable. Thus, where a town constable arrested a person who was intoxicated and imprisoned him in lockup until he became sober and then released him without taking him before a magistrate, he acted unlawfully as it is liable. In this case, the Supreme Court of North Carolina said, men may not be arrested in prison or released upon judgment or at the discretion of a constable or anyone else. If the alleged offense be criminal in its character, the officer may arrest and take the offender before a magistrate for trial. The constable arrested the imprisoned him not for safekeeping until he could be tried before a competent tribunal, but he imprisoned him until he became sober, according to his judgment, and then released him. The constable thus constituted himself the judge, jury, and executioner. This is the best description of despotism. When an officer institutes an arrest, he now has undertaken the duty to bring the arrested person to a magistrate. The person can only be released by judicial, not executive authority. The duty of one making an arrest to bring the prisoner before a proper magistrate, that proceedings for the trial of the prisoner may be instituted, and that he may have opportunity to give bail or otherwise procure his release, is even more imperative than if a warrant had been issued before arrest, and if the prisoner is released without being brought before such magistrate, the officer and private person who made the arrest becomes a trespasser ab initio. Arresting a person is a step in the prosecution, and if he is released, not according to law, it is an escape. Such an escape is a departure from a prisoner from custody before he is discharged by due process of law. If a person is arrested pursuant to a warrant, he must be taken to a magistrate before he can be released. Moving over to defenses now. Just as good faith does not excuse an unauthorized arrest, likewise, it does not justify an unreasonable detention and deprivation of one's liberty caused by a failure or delay in bringing one arrested before a magistrate. It has been a common practice for officers to drop off persons they have arrested at a police station or county jail and leave the prisoner in the custody of the others. This is a very dangerous and irresponsible act for an officer to follow. In doing so, the arresting officer relinquishes his duty and at his risk relies on others to lawfully deal with the arrested party. No officer can claim exemption from liability when he relies on others to take the arrested person before a judge without delay. He is responsible for the arrested person and cannot rely on others to perform his duty. Okay, so what, I don't know what the question is here now. How many times have I seen this happen? And we just, as a society, don't know where to go. Anyway, moving on now to distortions of fundamental law. As we look at common law principle and principles for arrest, which have existed for hundreds of years, as compared with the law enforcement methods employed by most tyrannical forms of government, it is evident that we are closer to the latter. There are several reasons for this trend towards oppressive control over the citizen. May I just add before I interject, because we're crickets. We're silent to our own rights. We don't look at the problem. We don't frame it. We don't understand the condition. I'm reading in these things where the courts have to have jurisdiction. They have to have a lawful place to put you, that you should be put somewhere the way it says. And that, how many times have I seen that violated? How many times have I articulated to you if you have a right of ingress and egress and they stop you at all? That's, by these definitions, false imprisonment that should be actionable, and none of us do that. And I say us. I've never done a false imprisonment case, and I'm looking back through my history thinking, wow, those lots of false imprisonment was going on. And I just sat there, like every other of the crickets, not knowing, as much as I'm studying, this is early on now, but not really responding. And there was a remedy there. And I tell you that I think the judges look at this, and when you don't exercise the remedy, they just bring you into the fact that you consent. Due process neglected is this heading underneath here, distortions of fundamental law. Due process, or the law of the land, is to act a shield against arbitrary activity of government. Since the days of King John and Magna Carta, history shows it is the first thing violated by overbearing rulers. In America, the due process provisions embraces common law maxims and principles. In fact, there are many cases where the courts would cite the common law requirements for the arrest without warrant, but then would cite a follow some statute on the arrest which was contrary to the common law principle. And now we're getting into the crux, if I'm interjecting now, the crux of how the occupiers have done the end run around. Let me offer here that it's going to come up later whether or not I get to it even this broadcast. They mention here King John and the Magna Carta. Some of you will gasp in horror, but I've cautioned you about relying on the Magna Carta and what happened to King John. And I'm saying this again right now because I'm anticipating whether or not I get into my next document that we're going to not hear in that document. They omit to say certain things. And one of the problems is who they're attached to by relationship and history. And what the Magna Carta, who recognized it and who didn't recognize it? And this then backs us back into when I start talking about this occupier and what we're under and how they've changed it. It goes back to even these times, the Magna Carta. But be careful. The Magna Carta isn't what most people think, even though it seems to be what people talk about as being valid. To the things I'm going to be explaining here in the near future, hopefully this broadcast, it's part of the trap. And it's part of what went on back where the Magna Carta was dealt with. And look at the larger picture, stepping back further, who was actually in control of England? And what did they say? So, little caveat, I guess, to be careful. On this point, this is where I say Charles Weissman is giving us information, but you really have to start qualifying what's going on and what may or may not actually be happening, what may not be going on relative to what you think is happening and what you make up in your mind as these people do what they do as their history and law tells them to do, and their occupiers. You notice them when you see them, when they started acting outside of the common law, as Charles Weissman is accurately showing you, despite he's recalling the common law of the Magna Carta, they're not even acting into that. Is showing you they're not acting where you think they are, and they're likely an occupying force. It's not just that they're not following it. It's that they're not following it for a reason. And we as a society have become the crickets we are to accept and feel everything's warm and cozy, and they're doing right by us, even though we're disgruntled and we don't like it. But in fact, they're absolutely violating the principles. If you can even get at those, if the occupier isn't so strong, they're going to deny them. And this is a whole other problem that we keep talking about. Why, why won't we mention it? Why we have to look for the maladministration in mass, find it, and then deal with it. Should I say alter and abolish it? And we didn't. So getting back to the discussion here in his writing, in nearly all these cases where statutes contrary to the common law were upheld, we failed to find argument asserting the requirement of the due process of law. And in very few of them was the arrested treated as a deprivation of liberty, which cannot be done except by due process of law. This departure from the common law on arrest is not all the fault of the courts, but also of those unlawfully arrested for failing to raise the proper arguments in court. While there are many cases in which the arrested party has asserted the common law rule on arrest, in most they have failed to also claim due process clause. Without such a constitutional plea, the statute prevails. And this is what I've been telling you, I think he's accurate in stating this part. This is how you get to your constitutional rights. You're not looking at the Constitution first. You're looking at the statute or code first. And you have to step your way back, like through those savings clauses that I keep talking about. And that's literally how they've kept us away from what we should get at. And they have lots of obstacles that they will put in our place in order to, so that we can't get back to that more stringent and strictly applied law. And this is where a lot of complaints about people are in codes and statutes and rules, and this is not law and all this other stuff. But you don't understand, it all works in a succession, and you have to, it's like a game, you have to trigger, you shouldn't have to, but this is why you know you're an occupation. You have to trigger each step that came after the fundamental law and show that it's invalid against you. Since the time of this country has founded, there have been hundreds of cases involving false imprisonment or unlawful arrest. Yet the proper due process argument is scarcely to be found among them. It is amazing that in 200 years of our country's history, so few have argued this most basic and important provision of constitutional law in defense of liberty in these cases. This failure to claim due process in arrest cases over this period of time certainly does not say much about those in the legal profession. The incompetency of the most lawyers, he calls them here, I don't think they're more than attorneys, was expressed by Chief Justice Warren Burger when he stated that 9 out of 10 lawyers are incompetent. Most lawyers are not independent thinkers. Instead, they are nothing more than a programmed robots who follow the path laid down by the prevailing system, whether it be just or corrupt. But when it becomes corrupt, then they will follow the corrupt rules and statutes above fundamental law. Let me interject. Why would that be? If those folks are agents of the occupier, why wouldn't they act like that? They're confined to those statutes. And that brings up a different problem now, immediately, once you start to see this condition. And I'm not going to say I have an answer for it. I'm saying I see it, and I've done my things to neutralize what I can with it, I'm trying to give you the information so you can too, while we maybe come together eventually to work this out, which I'm not feeling very confident in, but it's still there for us to do. And so I'm hoping for it. Hope and change. My own little hope and change. This failure on the part of lawyers is especially remarkable when we consider the ancient existence of the due process guarantee, and that it is prominently found not only in our Constitution, but in the Magna Carta, which proclaims, "No free man shall be taken or imprisoned or dispossessed, except by lawful legal judgment by his peers or by the law of the land." Now let me interject something here, and this is where I'm not going to get too much into contention, but I want to point out, I just pointed out the Magna Carta may not be what it is. And they may have thrown some stuff out, some meat for us to chew on. And then you look at the conditions in that statement. What if the occupier doesn't recognize that? You think you do. And what if there is no free man? Because you're occupied and don't know it. So I'm going to get a lot more loose about imposing what the law is. When you're an occupation, there is no law that you consider. It's in what the occupier will allow. And so here's where I start to get a lot of hesitation on how much I know and what I know and what it's going to be and how I'm going to impose that on somebody. If you're in a prison, you have no power. If you don't know you're in a prison, you think you have power. You'll make these proclamations believing the attorneys are there to do something and be competent. What was the Chief Justice speaking to? The competency of what? Maybe the Chief Justice didn't understand, which I'm not quite so sure. Incompetent in what? Protecting your constitutional rights, which the occupier doesn't want to give you? Seems like they're very competent in doing that. Anyway, looking at this a little bit different, flexing your elbows out a little bit, make some room around what you think you know, and try to revisit what's going on here. This is not, oh, no, we're going to do a false imprisonment. You got to look at the condition that, why didn't any lawyer argue the thing about the duty and the health official? Why? The thing I pointed out to you immediately. Why? Maybe because they mean it. Maybe because, as I told you, there's the bar association that the courts are amenable to promotes the very thing that you're watching. Do you think they're going to recognize common law, even if it existed in our most romantic notion of it? No, these are occupiers. These are foreigners. They're foreign and domestic in your lands. When you start seeing this, you got to stop saying that you have a right. No, you're being controlled. You're being controlled by an occupier. Now what are we going to do about that? Yeah, way far off the point. But let's get back to the document. I guess I'm just pointing out, you got to be very thinking. You can really be thinking about when you're looking at people's writings and what they assume is correct. Going to the article, the word taken is the word, has sometimes been translated as seized or arrested. The phrase law of the land means the same as due process of law and refers to law already established in the land. Thus, no one could be arrested except by the established common law that prevailed in the land. It does not mean some new law that the legislature might devise. I need to interject again as I'm reading this, and I've got to stop doing this, but it'll take a lot of time. Remember, the common law is judge-made law. It's made by these people, these occupiers anyway. The romantic notion of the common law may be in our minds, but what we're finding out is the common law that's inviolable is these things like trespass. That's the common law. That's prior to all this. But you have to get there. And they're not going to let you, is all I can tell you. And so you shrug your shoulder and give up, or do you start deciding, I've got some work to do with some people. I'm hoping you kind of figure that. I don't know that people can get together because they always have an opinion. They argue even with me while I'm talking and trying to advise what's going on things that we know that may not be so. The due process argument is a false imprisonment. In false imprisonment cases, will nullify the statute's rules and ordinances that are contrary to the common law rule on arrest. No legislative act can abrogate what is law of the land. Otherwise, there is no such thing as due process. The government has encroached upon the citizen's liberty by ignoring due process. I need to interject, and I'm going to stop here. They're ignoring due process because they're not the lawful government. Also, be careful that what has been deemed in the statute to be lawful due process is what they hold on to. And you're going to be hard-pressed to be able to argue that it's not. And so you have to look at that little bitty problem. Let me get on here and read, because we're going to run out of time again as I see this. So much to be reading on and discussing. The common law allowed arrests without warrant only for known felons and breaches of the peace. This is the required condition under due process of law in order to arrest someone. It has been said that arrest without warrant, where a warrant is required, is not due process of law. An arbitrary or despotic power no man possesses under our system of government. It should be quite obvious that if the legislature can say the arrest can be made without warrants for all misdemeanors committed within the presence of an officer, it can say that such arrest can be made when the misdemeanor is not in the presence of an officer. It also could say that the warrantless arrest can be made for mere suspicion because someone might break a law. You hear sustainability there? The precautionary principle? Anyway, go on. All would be subject to summary arrests without question or warrant. One of the main reasons the sword was put to King John to sign the Magna Carta, and why the American colonists took up guns against King George III and his army, was to prevent the arbitrary acts of government in depriving people of the right of their rights and liberties. However, human nature as it is, such arbitrary action is the natural tendency of those having power in government, and without the due process provision, government is free to encroach upon the rights and liberties of the citizens with immunity. So I need to go back. He's referencing this Magna Carta and saying this is the source of authority. I'm going to tell you, I want you to keep track of that, because that hasn't internationally been looked at as a source of authority. And remember, he looked right past the fact that there's a sword put to King John, the very reason that this document was negated by the international players. Moving on here to read, the term due process of law had a well-settled meaning when the Constitution was adopted. The framers thereof intended to perpetuate and secure the many principles, laws, and rights, all of which could not be listed against abrogation. Subsequent legislation cannot change the meaning of effect of these constitutional provisions, and thus cannot change the procedure by which one is deprived of the liberty by way of arrest. An arrest cannot be done except by the law of the land or due process. And I'm hesitating to argue here more, but I'll continue reading. Fourth Amendment argument. Another reason for the distortion of that has prevailed in the matter of arrests is the frequent misuse or misapplication of the Fourth Amendment in the United States Constitution or similar provisions in the state constitution used as a defense to arrest without warrant. The Fourth Amendment, which guarantees the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, generally does not apply to arrests made without a warrant, but only to those made with warrants. The provision regulates how warrants are to be issued. No warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath. If an arrest was made with a warrant, it must follow the criteria of the Fourth Amendment. Otherwise, it is an unlawful arrest, as the warrant would be illegal. But where there is no warrant, this provision is not applicable. Rather, we would apply the standards of due process of law. In one case in Illinois, where a person was arrested without a warrant, pursuant to a statute, the person arrested questioned whether the statute is in violation of the search and seizure section of the state constitution, similar to the Fourth Amendment. The Supreme Court said, but this section was applicable only to warrants. It does not abridge the right of arrest without warrant in cases where such warrants could be lawfully made at common law before the adoption of the present constitution. It is perhaps due to the ignorance of so many in the legal profession that we so often find Fourth Amendment arguments used as a defense against warrantless arrest. Now, in this article, and I'm not going to touch it today, it's too much to handle, there is a section, which I'm going to just tell you about. You can get this article and find it. It says highway traffic laws. And they go indeed, they discusses a whole lot of stuff in there relative to highway traffic laws. I'm not going to touch it today. There's too much to do. There's a whole other analysis that I would have to do as well. And this is the right of ingress and egress, as I adjust the terms for the grants that we are talking about. And it's still in a so-called common law, but it's also recognized as grant law. And these things could come apply, but they're not going to apply the way he says here. And I don't want to touch that because I don't want to give people the wrong idea why lots of people travel around in their cars, they got their licenses, or they don't, whatever. And you're going to be, this is the first line that the cops use to plunder everybody. And if I make some statements here based on this, it's going to really cause some potential trouble. And without the back story on this, without the back deeper learning, I don't want to make suggestions. So move on. I'll just let you know I'm not touching it for a good reason that I shouldn't. But it is a discussion that needs to be had. Because a lot of times this traffic stuff is where you find what appears to be these false imprisonments all the time. This is detaining you when they don't actually have a right is a problem. And I don't want to expand on that because then I'll get a lot of people thinking, oh, if I'm detained and now it's a false imprisonment. No, you have some elements to work out first. So it's, again, I don't want to give too much suggestion. And I don't want to give any ideas. It's not cut and dried. And I literally cannot find that we do not live in an occupied country and without foreign domestic forces that are controlling us, and we're not necessarily shouldn't expect to get to some of these things until more of us start figuring it out and more of us start doing more of the more proper things, maybe like a proper, more a number, numerous false imprisonment cases that are proper, don't set bad precedent either. Moving on to handcuffing, people's lack of understanding of the law and the lack of concern for it has allowed government to establish many unlawful and oppressive procedures in making arrests, etc. The use of handcuffs is a typical example of this. The practice of physical restraint by handcuffing, leg iron, rope, straitjackets, and the like have historically been limited to those who have been committed the most severe crimes, such as felonies, or have exhibited a violent temperament. In the Book 51 of the Lawyer's Reports and Annotated, page 216, are listed, several cases which show the rule pertaining to handcuffing procedures must depend upon the circumstances of each particular case. In citing the older English case, it was held that the right to handcuff one in custody may exist by reason of violence of language or conduct of that person. However, there cannot be a general rule that will justify a constable in resorting to the extreme measure of handcuffing a person in custody for a misdemeanor to a felon and marching them through the public streets from the public police station to the magistrate's office. One who is accused of or guilty of a misdemeanor cannot be lawfully handcuffed while in the custody of an officer, and in some cases the prohibition extends to a felon. Usually handcuffing is justified only where one has attempted to escape or has exercised violence toward the officer. But a constable cannot justify handcuffing a prisoner unless he has attempted to escape and unless it be necessary in order to prevent his doing so. There thus can be no general law which requires or allows the handcuffing of every one arrested, as in the rule the police follow. And how do we see this all the time? This is a big deal in my life. That changed. It used to be you just stand and talk, and there's like a little traffic, and they'd hand it to you and go away. Now they handcuff you and make a big old deal about it. Why? Because you're an open-air prisoner. They can treat you like that. And what do? We agreed. And so now it's common practice. And now I don't even know. Maybe it's statutory. Who knows what they can do now? Anyway, going back to here and reading, there thus can be no general rule which requires allowing handcuffs for every one arrested. In the English case of Osborne, Veitch, Foster, and Finn, English Rep. 317, where a lawful arrest was made for a misdemeanor, it was held that handcuffing was utterly unlawful. When the person in handcuffs sued the officer, a verdict was rendered for the plaintiff. The unwarranted use of handcuffs is regarded as an assault and battery, and the person viewing the handcuffing can be sued for trespass. Now, let me offer you, too, when they talk about these damages coming from a jury, the juries today don't think your constitutional rights are that important. And so you got to be cautious of that. Your so-called peers are people that are not so much peers anymore, and they're not. If you go look, what you have to have is a driver's license. You're in commerce to get on a jury anymore. So think about that one. That's your so-called peers when you go into these courts. So what kind of a court is that? Well, I might get to that if I get over to the other document now, leading into near the end, I hope, here. This is what I want to talk about. I want to rephrase quickly, remind you what all this knowledge did for Charles Wiseman when he went to court. And he finds out that when he gets to the courtroom, he's got attorneys and the judges coming out of judges' chambers. I'm going to paraphrase this and read the end. It was determined between the judges and the attorneys how the king was going to suffer underneath the violation to Charles Weissman's liberty. And Charles Weissman did not get relief, and he'll tell you in this case, in a paragraph. And what they did is they essentially paid for his time and his lawyer. And that was it. And so this is what I'm telling you. There's an occupying condition that he saw. He's an example of it. I've seen it myself. There's a privity in this condition that is not ours, that is not extended to us, that is not, the judge is not coming on and looking at your constitutional rights. With all this knowledge, all that was done was that we kind of wiped the slate. And we gave back the price of the attorney that you had to buy for Weissman, and everything was apparently copacetic. And he's saying here, additionally, in the last paragraphs of this document, problems such as these exist today because of the maxim, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, was not followed. Our continual suffering from the acts of corruption, oppression in the land, is the price we now have to pay for the failure of the past generations to guard the law and their liberty when threatened by acts of government. Yet the truth is that no one can protect a right he does not know exists. With this material, it is intended to inform many of the true law so as to guard their liberty for themselves and for the future generations. Future generations. Yeah. They're really beating that up, aren't they? But here we have, he's seen that back in 1993, he's seeing the same problem we're seeing today. It's worse. But I'm not so sure that this information is actually that going to inform you completely enough. Part of my interjection here throughout the this part of the broadcast. We're not stepping up. I agree with him. We're not. We haven't. I didn't in the past. I don't get involved now in those things that I need to at this point, and so I haven't had to exercise my latest. But those people I've helped recently in doing what I now see I think needs to be done have at least neutralized this condition where we don't see the relief common law would give to us. We don't even see the relief that beyond the common law, a grant of law in Congress actually gave to us. And so we're in a different kind of world that it's going to take a little better thought than us thinking we know so much, calling everything, fraud or whatever. Well, there's only certain ones. This can't be general either. You've got to identify a specific thing and then move with that. The material that I was telling you based on due process and looking at the health official is an example of an actionable thing that happened to us in the last couple of years. Those who work for a corrupt government do all sorts of unlawful acts to protect the system which feeds them. They must resort to lies, cover-ups, and distortions of law. But there is one thing that they can never do, and that is to give a just and lawful reason for their actions. That is a very insightful last sentence. That's what you're going to find when you go into courts and they just deny you or dismiss or just give they just lip service to a lawful reason based in a foundation. And that's how you ultimately identify them. But that means you have a different type of problem. To totally answer this, I'm not quite sure what the total answer would be because I can't find enough people actually understand this. They want to argue with the situation. And then they don't want to take action. If it is the way they say, they're not taking action that they think should be done. And I'm going to suggest you, when you start taking action based on those improper premises, you will find out very quickly how wrong they are. And you'll start finding yourself more like what we see in history and in the recent news over the last few years of lots of people going to jail for no good reason. And we're wondering where the justice is, and it doesn't exist. Now, so who are the people doing this? Well, you're talking about the judges and the attorneys, the attorneys. I want to now turn us to, and remember now, we're talking, going back historic, we're going to go historical now, where these things are, these people seem to start. And I want to try to give a little bit of a response to Weissman's observation that the judges and the attorneys come out of judges' chambers and then do what they did. He didn't get the full justice that the common law would provide to him, and no relief that the Constitution says is required to him. Okay, so what I want to turn to now is a document called The Inns of Court, an historical description of the Inns of Court and Chancery of England, 1909, by Hyacinth Ringrose, DCL. So chancery is your equity. So don't forget that we're talking about that as well. What is going on here? Because now we're going to go back in history a bit. We're going to merry old England. And for as much as America is supposed to be separate, look how many times we referred to the common law and England for the American law. So don't, anybody who thinks we're separate, you're deluded. And there's underlying reasons of this why it's not separate and why the Constitution is really a commerce compact. And why it was made after the Treaty of Peace, what the Treaty of Peace actually did. And this gets us into where? Commerce economy. And the Inns of Court play a crucial role in historic relevance to this and till today. If you go to look in the books, phone books. They even have phone books. Look around and look at the company registries and look for Inns of Courts of America. You'll see that they're around. State Inns of Courts or whatever with the name of state, they're around. They're not these archaic things. They exist today. And they have allegiances. If you look deep enough, they start having allegiances to these bar guilds whatever association you're talking about. The most notable one is the American Bar. The most notable one known as the American Bar is in the rules of your judiciary. Are your officers, your court officers, are members of this organization. And then their allegiance to the INSA court and how they follow this history has to be followed. But understand, we're going to read some stuff and find out what the history of this really is and what they really are about. And this is a, it's interesting, if nothing else. And I want to note here, before we move into that, we have this, understand when you're listening for these things, that there is the existence of the American Bar. I think you want to find a book called that written by Charles Warren's called The History of the American Bar. You'll likely find connections here. We want to listen for the City of London. And the City of London, it's like Washington, D.C. It's a jurisdiction on its own, but it's more important to that. It's an economic, financial center. When you now hear that, now we start linking that financial center back into the monetary players of the world, like such as the highest one, I believe, the BIS, the IMF and the World Bank, etc., all these things that are out there. So understand where I'm taking us here in relative to the INSA court and your courts and why Weissman's sitting watching the occupier, if you will, play around with remedy for wrongs done to him. Now I'm reading from the INSA court, an historic description, and this was to an American judge, and again, tie this back together to America, an American judge who has maintained on the bench of his native land those noble traditions which give splendor to our English Inns of Court, the Honorable Vernon M. Davis, Justice of the Supreme Court of the State of New York. And so I'm bringing together a condition here that seems to go past us about we think so highly about certain things, well, they think very highly about themselves. And they're making the decisions. And they're historic in their scope. And they're tied to the City of London. And it's not just a financial center, because it's another jurisdiction. It's the silent jurisdiction that I criticize all the time that has sway over England, that had sway and discussion relative to King John, that said the agreement you have with those, the peasants, your barons, does not interfere with our agreement with you. Reading from chapter 1. Introduction, one step aside, and listen to the historic context. I'm going to read through this just so we put ourselves in a place. And you got to kind of put yourself there a little bit and just understand the environment that this is in history until today and seemingly driving a lot of what we see, why maybe Charles Weissman didn't get the justice that so-called common law would have required or the Constitution for the relief to the harm done to the aggrieved would have gotten if there was not an occupier that looks like they're these people here. One step aside from the busy modern Fleet Street, the famous journalistic center of London, and in a minute be in the midst of a stately medieval building, spacious lawns and floral gardens and somber old quadrangles having all the appearance of a university town in the Middle Ages. This is the temple. This is a capital T temple. This is the temple where are situated two of the four ancient inns of court, Middle Temple and Inner Temple. These inns of court with the two others, Lincoln's Inn in Chancery Lane and Gray's Inn in Holborn, are voluntary non-corporation legal societies seated in London, having their origin sometime about the end of the 13th and or the beginning of the 14th century, and possessing by customary law the exclusive privilege of calling or admitting candidates to the bar. They may be regarded as colleges which together make up the official legal university of England. Formerly a subsidiary to the four inns of court where the nine inns of chancery were, now, however, have little beyond local connection with them and are let out in chambers to solicitors, barristers, and the general public. These are Clifford's Inn, Plymouth's Inn, Lion's Inn, now the site of the Global Theater, attached to the Inner Temple, New Inn and Strand Inn to the Middle Temple, Furnival's Inn and Thavies Inn to the Lincoln's Inn, Staple Inn and Barnard's Inn to Gray's Inn. Sergeant's Inn, Chancery Lane, was originally set apart for the use of the sergeants at law, whose name is derived from the fratius servitis of the Knights Templar, but the building has long since passed to other uses. The men of the law in England were anciently persons in holy orders, and judges were originally bishops, abbots, deans, canons, and archdeacons. In 1207, the clergy were prohibited by canon from acting in the temporal courts, and thereupon students of the law settled in certain hotels or inns, which were thenceforth called inns of court. They were called inns, according to Sir William Dugdale, because the students in them did there not only study the law, but use such other exercises as might make them the more serviceable to the king's court. Sir John Fortescue tells us that in order to serve the courts of justice and profit their country, the students of the inns of court did learn to dance, to sing, to play an instrument on the ferial days, and study divinity on the festival. The situations of the inn's court was admirably chosen with reference to objects of those institutions, being fixed in a locality free from the noise and bustle of the town, adapted for healthful full retirement and uninterrupted study, and at the convenient distance from both Whitehall and Westminster. I guess I'll pronounce it a little bit better. Westminster. No. Okay. Two societies of inns of the Temple, Middle Temple, and Inner Temple were located on the banks of the Thames. I won't read the little poetry, I'll just keep moving on. I've got to get through this. It would have been impossible to have selected a more delightful and more dignified situation with that majestic river in its original purity, a free atmosphere, open country, and a line of palaces stretching from the Temple to Whitehall. It is impossible to fix with certainty the exact period when the professors and students of the common law first began to associate themselves together as a society and form themselves into a collegiate order, or to assign an exact date to the foundation of the Inns of Court, the original institution of which nowhere precisely appears. There were persons learned in the law and skillful in pleading causes professionally employed as early as the reign of William Rufus, and in the time of Stephen, the municipal law were studied in monasteries, seminaries, and families of distinction. Now we're going to find out, if you look deeper, this goes into the Hammurabi law, actually, I think, that they were actually studying. Remember, this isn't a religious order. Let me also offer, I told you last week, international law recognizes something called civil law. International law does not recognize civil law like you know it. But here they talk about the next paragraph. And this is the key getting us into the financial center. This. And the Knights Templar. And I'm not doing a great analysis here. I'm just reading an article trying to point out some things and giving you a little bit of a tour of where this maybe potential possibility is and what we're seeing actually going on and why it's still considered and connected and why sometimes you'll see me talk about why the Pope is involved, why he's all into sustainable development, why the ABA is too. And that's not even the issue here. We're talking about you think you live under common law, what that is. They're actually practicing civil law. And civil law has an international definition. It has nothing to do with civil procedure. It's actually built into your federal code, and it's sitting in a different jurisdiction by run rule, Rule 9. They have a problem with that in the civil order, because it doesn't fit. And so they had to ameliorate that problem. But getting into the civil law, and I'm going to now highlight this, to the economic order, to the financial order, and the world order, the civil law, I'll just throw it out there, the mercantile, I'll put it that way, the civil law, which the clergy had exerted themselves to introduce into England, being impalpable to the nation, many persons at a very early date, devoted themselves with zeal and diligence to the study of the common law, or as it was called emphatically, the law of the land, which was taught in the city of London by learned men of the law who set up schools for the purpose. After the establishment of the Court of Common Pleas by Magna Carta, the practitioners of the municipal law took up their residences in houses between the King's Court at Westminster and the City of London, forming them one community, and before the end of the reign of Edward II, they appear to have divided themselves into separate inns or colleges as Temple Bar, Lincoln's Inn, and Gray's Inn. In the time of the Republic in ancient Rome, it was the practice for youths who designed to study to the law, the jurisprudence, and adopt the profession of the law after finishing the usual course of study in grammar, Grecian literature, and philosophy, to attach themselves as pupils to some of the eminent lawyers of the day, whose houses they frequented and whom they attended in public in order to profit by their example and experience. Those lawyers who were distinguished for their knowledge were consulted at their own houses. They gave their opinions, sometimes by word of mouth and sometimes in writing. In difficult cases, they consulted their brother lawyers near the Temple of Apollo in the Forum, and after consultation together pronounced a joint opinion. Students of the Roman law were called studius juris bel jurisprudentiae. Lawyers were styled advocatus casitiscus, juris consultus, and juris paratus. Under the emperor's lawyers, they were permitted to take fees from their clients after the conclusion of the cause. Schools for instruction in laws were open to Cassius and other eminent lawyers, the students being called auditories. Notwithstanding the occasional intrusion of base and venal men into the profession of jurisprudence in Rome, it was held in high respect. Cicero describes the house of an eminent lawyer as the oracle of the city. Pliny terms the profession of the lawyer the most honorable of all professions, and the Emperor Justinian immortalizes his name by their promoting its study and conferring upon its professors numerous awards and distinctions. In England, however, the legal profession had distinctly an ecclesiastical origin, of which we are reminded even in the present term of the court, which are named in the honor of St. Hilary, Bishop of Poitiers, Easter, Holy Trinity, and Michaelmans. In olden times, the lawyers awaited their knights for consultation in the round church of the Knights Templar, and similarly the sergeant at law were accustomed to resort to St. Paul's Cathedral, where each sergeant had a pillar assigned to him. Many old things and customs have passed away, even in conservative England, but the four inns of court still remain, and no man can be licensed to practice as a barrister or advocate in the courts of England unless he has become a member of and been called to the bar by one of these inns. The history of the inns of court is the history of English jurisprudence, and it is a history flavored by the most delightful romance. Writing of the Temple, William Makepeace Thackeray, himself a member of the Middle Temple, says in Pendennis, "Nevertheless, those venerable inns which have the lamb and flag and the winged horse for their ensigns have attractions for persons who inhabit them and share all of rough comforts and freedom which men always remember with pleasure. I don't know whether the student of law permits himself the refreshment of enthusiasm or indulges in the poetic reminiscences as he passes by historical chambers and says, 'Yonder Eldon lived, upon this site Cook mused, upon Littleton, here Chitty toiled, here Barnwell and Alderson joined in their famous labors, here's Byles composed his great work upon bills, and Smith compiled his immortal leading cases. Here's Gustav still toils with Solomon to aid him.'" Yes, that's Solomon. But the man of letters can't but love the place which has been inhabited by so many of his brothers or people by their creations as real to us as this day, as the authors in this day, at this day, as the authors whose children they were, and Sir Roger de Coverley walking in the Temple Garden and discoursing with Mr. Spector about the beauties and hoops and patches who are sauntering over the grass, and just a lively and figure to me as old Samuel Johnson rolling through the fog with a Scotch gentleman at his heels on their way to Dr. Goldman's chambers in Brick Court or Harry Field. Hold on, I got an interruption here. Fielding, I guess his name was, the inked ruffles and wet towel around his head, dashing off articles at midnight for the Covent Garden Journal. Covent? Is that how you say Covent Garden? Covenant? Ooh, Covent Garden Journal, while the printer boy is asleep in the passage. There was a passage in description of this, how highly they thought of themselves, I guess is what struck me there, why I read so much of it. This is a very highly esteemed order, and it's ecclesiastical. It is very restful to leave the crowded strand of to stroll for a while through the various temples and quadrangles of the temple, all rich, in their interesting associations. It was in the Fountain Court, the Ruth Pinch, the Martin Trusewith, was accustomed to meet her brother with the best laugh upon her face they ever played in opposition to the fountain and beat it all to nothing. The old fountain mentioned by Charles Dickinson was removed many years ago, but its site is still pointed out to visitors. I just want to interject here. These are all integrated, these people in history that we are relied upon, read their stuff, all discussed. These were all integrated people that were able, like, this is like a media that was able to promote themselves, that you hear written here, why we've been going through all this, these kinds of things. I mean, I'll probably jump a little bit on. What I want to read now is more to the point of the Knights Templar, the military. Remember, this is the military also of the ecclesiastical jurisdiction. Why this becomes so important, and why we're talking about civil law. It starts to tie together. Even before the men of law appeared within the hallowed precincts of the temple, had a history well worth telling. It was formerly a lodge of the Knights Templar, a religious and military order founded at Jerusalem in the 12th century under Baldwin, King of Jerusalem. These soldier monks were called Templars from their original designations as poor soldiers of the Temple of Solomon. Their life mission was to protect the Holy Sepulchre of our Savior from the sacrilege of infidels, to protect the pilgrims resorting thither. After the abolition of the order in 1312, Edward II gave the property to Aymer de Valence, Earl of Pembroke, whose tomb may be seen in Westminster Abbey. Let me interject back up on top. They got rid of the order, but it continued in a different form here, as you're going to read. I want to point that out. They were outlawed, but actually there's a contingent that continued. On this gentleman, Aymer de Valence, on his death, the knights of the rival order of St. John of Jerusalem, the Hospitallers, became possessed of the property, and soon afterwards it was leased to the barristers and students of law who have ever since, with characteristic tenacity, retained it. Now, I want to offer here, this looked like to me, this is how they did the shift. They could then not be part, the Templars were not part, but they brought in those they associated with that were going to advance the next, the continuation of their order through this new avenue, so-called the law, which were really just inns, and it sounded to me like they're just prostitutes if they're going to the inn and giving their, you know, doing their services. But anyway, that was something that crossed my mind. The temple property passed into the hands of the crown on the dissolution of the religious houses in the reign of Henry VIII. But this did not disturb the possession of the lawyers. Let me offer something. The king, like Henry VIII, was a guy, you know, off with your head, right? This guy would not have tolerated anything that was not conducive to him as well. And so listen inside that they're not talking about here. What was actually going on, and why might it have been going on? And what continues? What actually continues through these stages of apparent change, but in fact maybe not so much? You're just covering what was before in a new fashion. In 1609, it became, as it is today, the free hereditary property of the law societies of the Inner Temple and Middle Temple. The Inner Temple is so called from its position within the precincts of the city. The Middle Temple derives its name from the situation between the Inner and Outer Temple, and the Outer Temple is today the name of the modern block of law houses and chambers directly opposite the Royal Courts of Justice. The two inns, Middle Temple and Inner Temple, possess in common the old church of the Knights Templars, consecrated as the Church of St. Mary, better known today as the Temple Church. They are two parts of the Temple Church, the round church built by the Templars in 1185, and the early English choir, which is an addition to the round church being built in about 50 to 60 years afterwards. The chief features of the round church are the nine tubes of crusaders with recumbent figures in black marble in full armor and the oft-repeated heraldic emblems of the temple, the lamb with the flag, being the arms of the middle temple, being the arms of the middle temple, and the winged horse, Pegasus, being the arms of the inner temple. A slit in the wall of the round church makes a small penitential cell where knights who had broken their vows were imprisoned and starved to death. Through the slit, which took the place of a window, these unfortunates could hear in their dying moments the services of the church. The services held today are conducted in the early English choir conformably to the rites and usages of the Church of England. The members of the Middle Temple have their place on the left as one enters and the side of the organ, which was presented to the temple by Judge Jeffreys of an inenviable fame. The members of the Inner Temple sit on the right or the opposite. The center of the choir, capital C, your choir, is reserved for invited guests. The pastor of the temple church is called the master of the temple, an office which has been filled by many eminent divines. In the churchyard of the temple can be seen the grave and effigy of the author of the Vicar of Wakefield with the inscription, the simple inscription, "Here lies Oliver Goldsmith." I'm pausing on that. I think this is a big deal. They're talking, remember, this is in the city of London. This is financial. It was in the beautiful Smith Temple that, according to Shakespeare, were plucked the red and white roses, which were assumed as the badges of the rival houses of Lancaster and York in the bloody civil contest known as the Wars of the Roses. I'm going to skip a big jump here with a poem. The Temple Gardens were once famous for their chrysanthemums and brilliant show, which was held every November. The magnificent hall of the Middle Temple in which the masters of the bench, barristers, and students dine were erected in 1572 and has been an artistic open-work ceiling in old English oak. Harry Potter comes to mind about that symbol, but anyway, that scene. But the walls are embellished with armorial bearings of the Knights Templar and five full-length portraits of princes, including an equestrian portrait of Charles I. I want to keep talking about this armorial thing and the fact that the Knights Templar were moved away, yet they never removed, when the lawyers took it, they never removed these symbols. They never got rid of those examples. And so I'm saying that they, because of that, and they say they remodeled these things over and over again, this is still a consistent heritage. And it would go, I'm going to stop here about the moving on. They start talking more and more relative to time. 1601 Shakespeare's play, The Twelfth Night, was acted in this hall, in this temple. So these are very close. These people of history, these literary works that we read like it's just somebody making up stories. These were people who were connected. The hall has often been a scene of costly entertainments at which the royal personages have been present. England's present king, this is back in 1909, His Majesty Edward VII, is a member of the Middle Temple in of court. So is Honorable Joseph A. Coit, and distinguished American lawyer who was a few years ago ambassador to the United States to Great Britain. Connect, connect, connect. Never a historic break, ever. The present Hall of Inner Temple dates only to 1870, but it is a handsome structure adorned with statues of Knights Templar and Knights of the St. John of Jerusalem. Lincoln's Inn, the third of the inns of the court, importance is situated without the city on a site once occupied by the mansion of the Earl of Lincoln and other houses. I'm going to offer that's also the chancery side, remember. Prior to the erection of the present Royal Court of Justice, the High Court of Chancery held its sittings here, entering by the picturesque gateway of the Lincoln's Inn Fields. We see the first hall and library red brick. It goes on and discusses these things. I do want to point out who was there. We talk now moving to the Gray's Inn, and that in the Elizabethan Hall, Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors was acted in the year 1594 for Gray's Inn, and the Archbishop's window in the chapel has figures representing St. Thomas of Becket, Whitgift, Jugson, and Laud of Wake. The last four archbishops were members of the Ancient and Honorable Society of Gray's Inn of Court. The inn takes its name from the Grays of Wilton, who formerly owned the land upon which this is situated. Among the distinguished members of the Gray's Inn are numbered of Lord Chancellor Sir Francis Bacon, Fry Your Bacon, Thomas Cromwell, Lord Burleigh, on and on. These people are of history, are all part of this, all part of an influence that's been going on for a long time. The four inns of courts are all equal in their authority and privilege. No one takes official precedence over the others. There are rules concerning the admission of the court. There are rules concerning the admissions of the courts and the mode of keeping terms of education and examination of students, and the calling of candidates to the bar are uniform and identical. Now go look at your law and your rules that say that the ABA rules are going to be uniform and you can't go become a bar member of the court until you go through their system, is the condition here, always uniform and historic. The members of the Inn of Court consist of benchers, barristers, and students. The benchers are the governing body of the inns and are composed of the senior members designated more formally as masters of the bench. They are self-elected and unrestricted as to the numbers, usually a member of an inn upon attaining the rank of King's Counsel is invited to the bench. The duties of the benchers relate to the supervision and management of the court, concerns of the inns, and admissions of candidates as students, the calling of them to the bar, and exercise of the discipline over the members. The judges of why you don't find attorneys, but meeting with attorneys and making closed deals that don't provide the relief under the Constitution. Interjection. Okay, back. The judges of the superior courts are visitors, are the visitors of the inns, and to them alone can an appeal be made through their process here. I want to go through all that. We can read more. I want to get down to, though, reading now into chapter 2, quickly, the temple court and precinct. So, talking completely ecclesiastic, these lawyers, they call them lawyers. They're actually attorneys. They're actually favored to the king, and they sit between the king and you. All right? Understand that, how they set this thing out as you go through the temples, to the outer temple. That's where you get connected to it, but it's all the same system. The round church of the temple is the first of the four round churches still existing in London. The Templars did not, however, always build round towers resembling the temple or Jerusalem, but such was largely their practice. The restoration of the beautiful relic was one of the first symptoms of the modern Gothic revival. The reign of Charles II, the body of the court of the church, was filled with pews and concealed bases and columns, while the walls were encumbered to the height of the 8 feet from the ground with oak wainscoting, and on they go on. And in the year 1706, the church was wholly new and whitewashed. This becomes a little bit of discussion. Also figures the Knight Templars were cleaned and painted, and the ironwork enclosed them with gilded with gold and painted. In other words, there's reverence to the old Templars, even though they were supposedly destroyed, right? So this is what I want to point out. The reverence that's given to this is not removed, and that's a military factor, right? That's what I want to point about, getting us back to the civil law, which we're going to get to quickly. The first real step towards the restoration of the temple church was made in 1825. As they go through, they're building this up, but they never get rid of their history and connection to the Templars. what I want to point out and show here as we go down to page, I think 39 it is, where they reference again this armorial type of thing where they talk about the footing that this whole thing, it never removes itself from the military area. The mail-clad effigies on the pavements of the round of the temple church are not monuments of the Knights Templar, but associates of the temple who are partially admitted to the privileges of the powerful order, the powerful order. This is not inconsequential. During the last repairs, there were found two Norman stone coffins and four ornamented leaden coffins in small vaults beneath these effigies, but not in their original positions. Stowe, in 1598, speaks of eight images of armed knights in the round walk. The effigies have been restored by Mr. Richardson, the sculptor. The most interesting of these represents the Geoffrey de Magnaville, Earl of Essex, a bold baron who fought against King Stephen, sacked Cambridge, and plundered Ramsay. He was excommunicated and while besieging Burwell Castle was struck by an arrow from a crossbow just as he had taken off his helmet to get air. The Templars, not daring to bury him, soldiered him up in lead and hung him on a crooked tree in their riverside orchard. The corpse being at last absolved, the Templars buried it before the west door of their church. He is to be known by a long pointed shield charged with rays and a diamond field. I want to point out this armorial thing. This is a military order. The civil law in international law is admiralty. That is the law merchant. This is for merchant's law. This is a centered power that has its representatives from the king and authorized by the king to go out into the world and promote all this stuff. There's no distinction in some regard between America and these attorneys. And if there was, it was undone when their agents infiltrated into our country. As I pointed out, there's like 26 states in the United States of America where the permanent laws of the people were removed and substituted, supplanted, appeals courts say, supplanted. International law is an overthrow, supplanted for the permanent laws of the people. These people did that. These people in a religious order, a military religious order, did that, promoting civil law, which is international law for admiralty. For those of you that talk about admiralty, and why I say, well, if you understand you're an admiralty, maybe you should understand how to do some, at least the neutrality parts of it, and respond through it. You don't talk about it. You put that in your hip pocket. You just respond as if you are in that jurisdiction, and you respond properly. But the problem here is we have it looks like a military ecclesiastical order in charge of things. And your rules of the court impose this order internationally across the pond, and the rules are consistent across the board to do whatever this order wants. And it ends up being the civil law has to be the law merchant for those of you that understood the UCC. But don't go spouting it because it doesn't really matter that way. You have to address each individual thing as you go forward. And so I hope today I've given you some insight, study beyond what I've done here. I've had to go quickly, and hopefully you'll see maybe a potential possibility of connection to why we're where we are and what it might be that gives you insight here to do when we start to come to terms with what's really going on. I'll be with you next week, Tech Tips for Nature Willing.
Well, that's another lesson. I hope with today's information you can take it to those that misbehave. From behind the woodshed, leaving his mark on the beast, this is Hal Anthony. Till next time, journey with purpose.
foot opening up a can of whoop-ass feels like.
Son, I just opened a whole case of whoop-ass.